This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a plea that the new movement for justice not forget the plight of political prisoners in the United States. Cynthia McKinney speaks out on the poisoning of Flint, Michigan's water. And a transitional government has been appointed for Haiti, which no longer has a president. But first, DeRay McKesson, the Twitter communicator, who was a charter school supporter in Minneapolis before he joined the Movement for Justice in Ferguson, Missouri, is running for mayor of Baltimore as a Democrat. McKesson's Campaign Zero organization met twice with Hillary Clinton, and he has developed a close relationship with the National Democratic Party. Black Maryland state lawmaker Jill Scott, who once ran for mayor herself and is considered the most radical politician in Baltimore, calls DeRay McKesson's campaign ridiculous and explains why she's not going to run for City Hall this year.
First of all, it's a very difficult decision not to run for mayor at this time when it seems like the people are desperately seeking something different than the traditional Democratic policies and candidates that put us into the current plight that we have. But I don't think that many people here really know DeRay McKesson. I don't believe he is from Baltimore, and I don't even know that he lives in Baltimore, but he hasn't been part of any movement or any struggle here, or any social circles other than possibly social media. So I don't think he has strong chances. My concern is that he may cause a greater wedge in the justice movement and divide people that are fighting for good causes even further apart in terms of splitting people that maybe support him and may not support him, and then that we lose sight on the real issues, because I don't think that there's any chance of becoming mayor. And the one good thing is maybe he'll raise some issues that others won't raise, but I don't think that at the end of the day it's anything that we should be putting our energy into.
Well, one of the issues that certainly he would raise as mayor or as a candidate for mayor would be charter schools. He's a member of Teach for America, and that is a corporate-funded proponent of charterization of the public schools.
You know, that's actually pretty scary, because Democrats here have always long struggled to maintain a distinction between themselves and Republican counterparts, and that's been one area where Democrats have struggled to fight the charter school movement, and Baltimore is failing miserably now. Baltimore is in the midst of numerous school closings and shutdowns, and traditional neighborhood schools that are very good. So I think DeRay McKesson, to the extent that he represents that, that's a dangerous proposition, but it's also more dangerous because it might actually give him some additional support.
DeRay McKesson may not have roots in Baltimore, but he's had good things to say about your former mayor and governor and former presidential candidate.
The best thing that's happened in this political season is that Martin O'Malley is out of the picture on the national scene, the state scene, and the local scene. He's a large reason why we are in where a lot of cities and states are, but Martin O'Malley helped us get where we are because he is responsible for the arrest of 750 people over the period of time he was mayor of Baltimore. And anyone that supports Martin O'Malley and anyone that supports those policies is naturally an enemy to any kind of justice movement or movement for Black people.
DeRay McKesson has become a prominent personality because of his involvement in the Black Lives Matter movement. He's one of the heads of Campaign Zero. But how could a person of that kind of background support Martin O'Malley, whose reputation in terms of Black police community relations is about as low as it gets?
Well, no one authentically for the cause of Black people or for the cause of justice could ever support Martin O'Malley. And so that definitely calls into question McKesson's authenticity and sincerity. But when I first saw the support on social media that he gave for O'Malley, I initially thought that it was just that he was ignorant. He didn't know the history or understand the history. But through further research and understanding, I think that it was probably intentional, which should call into question D. Ray McKesson altogether. But I don't think that he's going to gain a lot of ground. I think he's going to get, sadly, a lot of media attention because they're already giving him, to be honest with you, they're already giving the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, already giving him way more attention than they've given even some of the other candidates that probably have more credibility and legitimacy. So that's what he'll do. And also in any campaign, you have to raise a lot of money, and I hate to see money being raised for a bad purpose or a purpose that's absolutely futile. And I think that's also something that's likely to happen.
Well, TFA, Teach for America, is corporately quite well connected. Money may not be a problem for Mr. McKesson.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. But I think that there was talk about this other guy that people wanted to run here named Wes Moore. I'm not sure if you know who he is, but it sounds like D. Ray McKesson may be Wes Moore, or even worse than Wes Moore. So basically the corporate kind of phony candidate that was being heavily pushed here, that may be the role that D. Ray McKesson has now assumed. The pool of potential candidates to become the next mayor, none of them have yet articulated a vision for fixing the problems in the city. Some of, like, piecemeal different platform items, but nobody has articulated a vision for what law enforcement should look like in a fair and just city. No one has done that. No one has talked about the school problem with lack of adequate funding, but also how to reverse this effort to close all of these neighborhood schools, which are hubs of the communities, in favor of building what's considered to be a 21st century model, but is often not well thought out and not ultimately in the best interest of the children in the neighborhoods.
Well, there's one candidate that's only a degree of separation away from law enforcement, and that's the councilman, Nick Mosby, who's the husband of the prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby, the person responsible for bringing charges against those police officers in the death of Freddie Gray.
Well, many people believe that Nick Mosby's fate as a mayoral candidate is going to be somehow determined, or initially they thought, by the outcome of the cases for the officers charged in the Freddie Gray case. I don't actually think that's going to happen because it's not looking like those cases will be resolved by the election, certainly not the primary election. But I don't think Nick Mosby has much of a chance because, again, he really doesn't have a long or strong record of service, and his wife's name has now put him on kind of the radar, but I think the race is going to come down in Baltimore between two people, the former mayor Sheila Dixon and the state senator Kathy Pugh. David Warnock is a candidate that has a lot of money, and he may come in third. But the others, I think, are just wasting time.
There's electoral politics and there's movement politics. What effect has the long, drawn-out nature of the case against those policemen had on the movement in Baltimore?
Well, I can't say that the long, drawn-out process has been a source or a cause of weakening the movement, but I would say that the movement is quiet movement, and it is somewhat fragmented. You know, I have seen splintering of groups and organizations that were once together united at the beginning of this process, a year ago today. But I think, you know, we'll weed out the authentic people that are truly about change and progress from the ones that were not. The same as with the candidates. You know, many of the candidates are throwing their hats into the ring now because it's popular now to want to change Baltimore and to be a spokesperson for that, as opposed to authentically wanting to be in leadership. So I think that the movement is going to remain the movement. The movement, sadly, has no candidate for mayor at this time or for city council president at this time, or, well, some would say maybe for some of the city council seats, but that really depends on whether or not one believes that a Democrat Party candidate of any type can really be a change agent.
And many hope that you would have been that candidate. You seem to feel that DeRay McKesson's entrance into the race might exacerbate the disunities that afflict the movement.
I think it might, because I think that it'll pull on some people in his direction and others that will be vehemently opposed to him. But, you know, at the end of the day, because he did file as a Democrat, what he probably does, what his filing most likely does is ensure the victory of one of the worst candidates in the race, because he will further split the black vote and he will further split Democrats. And so, in my opinion, you have Sheila Dixon, who was in the lead, the former mayor that was ousted in disgrace for committing a theft and stealing gift cards. But she's in the lead now, and then everyone else is vying for their position. I think that anybody that gets into the race helps to ensure a Sheila Dixon victory.
Maryland State lawmaker Jill Scott, speaking from Baltimore. Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer who served 28 months in federal prison for the crime of zealously defending her client, and her husband, Ralph Pointer, the veteran human rights activist and educator, want to make sure that the incipient new movement for justice keeps up the fight to free all political prisoners. We spoke with the couple in Brooklyn, New York.
We knew that confronting the Guild on this is like herding cats. There's something about the fact of political prisoners, and I think particularly black political prisoners, and that whole history of movement that were doers, that were out there actually doing something, that somehow affronts the Guild. The Guild wanted to do, let's go to court on everything. And there were, of course, so many people who recognized in the 60s, myself, I hope, among them, that the courts were not where the action was. The courts were not going to solve the problems we saw then. And actually, ironically, the same problems we saw then are the problems we see now. And I still feel the same way. Yes, the courts as a showcase, as something, but let us not divert our energies into the courts, because if we do that, we lose the streets, and the streets is where it's got to happen.
Yeah, well, one of the things that Lynn proved as an activist first, before she was a lawyer, she was in the streets. We did things. And the moment she became a lawyer, she was recognized by those activists. And one of the things that she says over and over again, well, the left didn't move to support the black warriors, you know, the Black Panther Party, et cetera, the Black Liberation Army, but they kept saying they were waiting for the white working class. And then when the white working class came along with the Ohio 7, Weather Underground, et cetera, they still held back and did nothing. And this enraged Lynn, you know, and she jumped into the defense of those activists with all 4 feet. And this is what makes her different. And this is when they say to Lynn, hey, you know, you're more than a lawyer. You're one of us. It is so very true. She is more than a lawyer. She's one of us who believes that the government can't deny an act. When someone does an act, you can't explain that away. And instead of the left supporting the act, they to say, hey, it's bad. They called them all kind of names, adventurous, et cetera. It's the wrong time for revolution. And I would say, well, who knows when it's right? Revolution is when you feel it, you do it, and the people who like what you have done support it.
I'm going to cut in on Ralph, mainly because I think that what goes on and is still going on and is why we do not get the kind of support for the political prisoners that we should get is because there is still this dichotomy in the movement that says we can't support people who shot cops. We can't support people who took over land and refused to give it up without a firefight. We don't like violence. Anything violence, we don't like. And the Guild is a lawyer's organization. It is more radical than other lawyer, obviously, organizations. And yet, even in my case, and I was one of their own, Ralph can tell you stories about their lack of enthusiasm, let's put it that way, to really be supportive of me. And the position I was in, which really could very simply be defined as being a lawyer who was too good and too enthusiastic, nothing more than that, and they still declined to really support me.
Too many lawyers said to me, Lynn should have kept her mouth shut. And my response was, very interesting. And I don't know how old you are, Glenn, but I used to respond with, you know, we as Americans are very much influenced by the movies. We learn history from the movies. And I don't know if you remember James Cagney. In his movies, when he would be arrested, he would put his feet on the sergeant's desk and say, I want my mouthpiece. This is what lawyers are supposed to do. Speak for us. This is a trite way of putting it. To James Cagney, I says, we should at least learn that. Where's my mouthpiece? Who's going to speak up for me in this situation? Although we knew there was nothing political about James Cagney in his movies. He was a bandit, a robber. He kept it for himself. But this was what the law was supposed to represent. Your mouth pinching. How dare they say she should have kept her mouth shut. That is, don't defend people that the government doesn't want defended. And all I saw was the same treatment for Muslims that we as people of color have received over the years, you know, repeat.
And what was the reaction of the guild members? Were they shamefaced or did they dig in their heels?
Rank and file was very different from what I guess you would call the leadership. The rank and file was very much, these were people that I had been down in the trenches with. These are people when they were, for example, I think about a couple, they're Zionist, but still they are the leading lawyers for all the protesters in the state of Washington. Strong guild members, and they know that when we were in Washington State, we went to Tacoma when they were being arrested for stopping the shipments of arms to Iraq. They knew that we supported them, and they were very, very active in supporting me. I mean, I earned it, and yet the organization was not going to do that. They were not going to back it. But individuals, and the proof of the pudding was when Ralph got to the convention, and they had allotted him something like 5 minutes to speak. We had to finance the trip to the convention. We had to finance a room at the hotel. We had to finance the whole thing. When he got up and just mentioned my name, it was a standing ovation for the next 5 minutes. And at that point, he said he thought to himself, Lynn was right. I should come here. This is big support, and this is important support. And in a friendly sense, I always felt that by supporting me, they supported themselves. Because if this is what our ideal as lawyers is, and I'm not saying I was the first that ever did this. Bill Kunstler did it, and certainly Ramsey Clark did it over and over and over again. But I was the first one maybe that the government came down on. And of course, I think it definitely had something to do with who I was defending, who I had defended in the past, and I think my associations with the black movement in the 60s.
Back in the 80s, on the lips of millions of people and plenty of lawyers, were the words Free Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was a political prisoner. He was charged with violent acts committed as head of the armed element of the African National Congress. But there were hundreds and hundreds of political prisoners in the United States back then. And there are still large numbers of political prisoners, fewer now than back in the 80s, because many have died.
Yes, well, one of the things that I keep trying to remind people of, why did they keep Nelson in so long? And the answer is because he refused to renounce violence in the pursuit of liberation. Very simply, they would have let him out in a day if he would have made a Martin Luther King-like statement, nonviolent resistance. And we have to note the difference. We have to say we are human, and we have the right of self-defense. And defending the community is exercising that right. And anything less than that is dehumanizing. It's one thing when somebody else dehumanizes you. It's something else when you dehumanize yourself. I renounce the right of self-defense. And that's what we have done. And we are in a culture of renouncing the right of self-defense when we don't defend those brothers and sisters who defy the government the same way the government defied their right by using force. And we see our kids being killed every day and still no response. And I think Mumia made a statement about when you see an act of violence or when you see an act of injustice and you do nothing about it, you are already dead. He does it much better than I do. That's why he's Mumia and I'm just Ralph. But you get my drift.
One of the things we want to do, and this is our primary political activity aside from other things, but is the freedom of these men and women who are locked up for nothing more than their really political aspirations in the past. But I wanted to say, we do want to draw parallels to Nelson Mandela to say, these are, Sundiata Okoli is our Nelson Mandela. And we want to also draw parallels to the Puerto Rican political prisoners who are very similarly situated in terms of crimes, quote, crimes committed, acts, expropriations, etc. And yet they were able to organize within their community, organize people to say, if you don't bring these people home, we are not voting for you. I'm not a big believer in electoral politics, but we know that worked, and that is why ultimately Clinton, in order to protect his then-ambitious political wife's candidacies in New York, where there was a large Puerto Rican population, used that to get them home. And we ought to learn from that. I don't know of any of the black politicians who has come out and said, free the political prisoners as a generic thing, or free so-and-so as a political prisoner. It just isn't in the agenda. And we have got to take these folks who are mostly so corrupt and just shake them till they rattle, until they understand they're not going to get back in office. Of course, that presupposes we can organize the people to say, I won't vote unless they do this. And the campaign is immense, and I'm just hopeful we can get it off the ground.
And could I conclude with this, Glenn? I was talking to one of the leaders of the freed Puerto Rican political prisoners, and quietly, and he says, Ralph, he says, you have an advantage over me, and you're trying to organize political prisoners, he says, because black people are more sophisticated politically than Puerto Ricans. And I says, no, 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 you have an advantage over me because Puerto Ricans know and want to be Puerto Rican. And black people, we know, are not in that situation. They do not want to be black. They do not know they are black. We have a problem, Houston. And it's, we have met the enemy, and they are us. So this is where we are. We have a hill to climb, but we must get there, because I know how I felt every day when I walked away from that prison or when Lynn hung up on the phone. She is in their grasp, and what the hell can I do? And it fired me up every day, and I'm still fired up because I speak to Sekou Odinga, who got out after 22 years, and then I think of Leonard still in there, and all of our brothers and sisters, and it just makes me crazy.
Human rights activist Ralph Pointer, along with his wife and former political prisoner Lynn Stewart. A congressional committee has been holding hearings on the catastrophe in Flint, Michigan, the majority black city whose water was poisoned under the control of an emergency financial manager. Dr. Cynthia McKinney, the former six-term congresswoman from Georgia and 2008 Green Party presidential candidate, was active in congressional hearings on the Katrina disaster back in 2005. McKinney is now in Bangladesh, teaching a course in political science and leadership, the discipline in which she earned her Ph.D. We asked Dr. McKinney if she thinks the current hearings will succeed in holding powerful people and government agencies accountable for what happened in Flint.
Well, I don't know why the governor wasn't subpoenaed. I mean, they've already started out with a bit of discrimination, right? But, you know, we've been down this road before. As I said about the select committee for Benghazi, that it's selective outrage. Where has the Congressional Black Caucus been on Detroit? That was a situation where you've got all of that water there, but they were turning people's water off. I went up to Detroit and people were fighting in order to be able to have water. The people in Flint, it's a crime. And now you've got the people in Flint who had water, and they're being told that, well, you still got to pay your water bill. And look at the water that they've got. You got indigenous people, Native Americans. The EPA goes and pollutes a whole river on which they depend for their drinking water. I mean, so it's not just Flint, but it's this problem of selective outrage that you can have Elijah Cummings exclaim in the Benghazi hearing, we're better than that. So I prime my ears ready for what's about to come, because I'm sure he's about to say, we're better than that. We're not a country that does this to other countries. We're not a country. And you can fill that in, fill the blank in with whatever, foreign policy or domestic policy. We're better than that. And then he goes on to say, we're so much better. We're a better country. We're better than using taxpayer dollars to try to destroy a campaign. That's not what America is all about. And then the entire room erupts in applause. It's political theater. It's selective outrage. You've got an American ambassador that's dead in Benghazi. You've got gun running from Libya into Syria. You've got all of the stuff that's wrong with U.S. policy. And the only outrage that was expressed by the leading Democrat was that we're using taxpayer dollars to try and destroy a campaign. Now, Hillary Clinton is counting on the black vote to bail out her campaign. Can you believe this? It's political theater, and I choose not to pay a dime to watch it.
There was no outrage, certainly not from the Obama administration or from the Congressional Black Caucus when the emergency financial manager regime was put in place, resulting in half of Michigan's black population effectively being disenfranchised. And it was the emergency financial manager regime that led to the poisoning of Flint. But no outrage at the time from the caucus or the president.
You're absolutely right. And I've been up to Benton Harbor. Where is Reverend Pinckney? Reverend Pinckney is in prison. I personally spoke to Representative John Conyers, at least to say, support Reverend Pinckney. Nothing, nothing. Go to Benton Harbor. And so it's not just Flint. There's something incredibly wrong with our polity. But I have been saying for 20 years, and quite frankly, I'm sick and tired of saying it now. There's something terribly wrong with the black body politic. It's not just got a disease. It's comatose. And radical surgery needs to be performed or else we're going to lose this patient, right? And it's not happening. It's just not happening. We keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and wondering why we're dying. The vital signs are in trouble. They've been in trouble. And if we don't act very soon on a multitude of fronts, we will be dead because we will be politically irrelevant. And it's something that we will have done to ourselves, not heeding the call of people like you, people like me. You've got a panoply of voices out there that are a part of the Black Agenda Report family that are begging people to open their eyes, to change their behavior. It's not enough for us to receive statistics every year on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday about how bad the situation is. The only thing that's required is a political intervention. And we are not going to get that intervention by doing what we're doing now. We're not going to get the necessary result, a changed result, because we're not doing the necessary changing of our interventions.
Reverend Pinckney is Reverend Edward Pinckney, the Black activist who was imprisoned on political charges. He's from Benton Harbor, which was one of the majority Black cities taken over by the emergency financial managers. But these financial managers also take over school systems, including Detroit's school system, which has been in the news lately because of its deplorable conditions, overseen by an emergency financial manager. But these state takeovers of school systems occur around the country and largely under Democrats.
They're trying to do that in Georgia as well. And I'm hoping that that doesn't happen, their foray into the South. I'm hoping it's not successful. But when you have elected representatives who understand that the best way to survive is to roll over or allow the system to roll over the people that they're elected to protect, we're in a bad situation. A recent example of the value of speaking up is we had a sheriff who was hounded out of office and charged with 30 some odd counts of fraud and all that sort of stuff. And it was just that we had elected a Black sheriff and that was just not supposed to happen. And so one Black woman state legislator, when the governor was about to prevent him from being sworn in, one Black woman in the Georgia legislature said, no, he was elected by the people of Clayton County and he deserves to be able to serve. There is no voice higher than that of the people. Governor backed off. He's been in office. Charges dropped and the election was allowed to stand. But if we don't exercise our voices and we don't protect the ones who do choose to exercise their voices, then everyone is in the play it safe mode. And that's exactly what's happened. I've been watching the fiasco. I've written on RT.com. I've written about the fiasco that's going on down in Haiti right now. And the shame of it all is that this is happening in Haiti, and it's been caused by one of our presidential candidates. Hillary Clinton denied the people in 2010 their right to self-determination when she went down and interfered with the election results and said, oh no, that person can't be elected because that person is too close to Hugo Chavez. And so then in the administration that was installed at her behest, her brother ends up getting a gold mine. And she's not been asked one question during this campaign, not one question by members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Well, how did your brother get a gold mine against the wishes of the people of Haiti who did not want to mine their gold because they're still trying to get their gold back from the Federal Reserve that stole their gold when the U.S. troops came in? So there's a whole lot of business that is not being handled. And I don't want to get my blood pressure up by worrying about what the Congressional Black Caucus is not doing, because the people have been informed and the people do have a responsibility to inform themselves. The information is there. I can go all over the world and all I have to do is click. I don't have to pay one dime. I can even go to the free restaurants and get the free Wi-Fi. So you can go all over the world. You can get whatever information you want to have. And if you choose to look at what Kanye West and Kim Kardashian are doing, or Caitlyn Jenner, as opposed to what your Congressional Black Caucus is doing and the people that you elect to represent you, then that's our problem. And it's also our shame.
So Hillary Clinton participates in the rigging of Haitian elections. She's the biggest cheerleader for war against Libya. And when the leader of that country is killed, she says, "We came, we saw, and he died." And yet she gets overwhelming support from Black elected officials.
You're absolutely right about that. I don't hesitate to write about it on RT.com. I write every week. I write a column. And I wrote about how Hillary Clinton is turning Haiti into a vassal state of the Clinton family. I wrote also about Clinton and the Benghazi Committee and the total destruction of an African country. So I do my best to put it out there. I post it on my Facebook page, Cynthia McKinney Official. I do what I can. I know you guys are doing what you can. BlackAgendaReport.com. It's now up to the people to do something. I also would just like to mention two organizations that are doing yeoman's work. And I wish that I had so much money that I could just give to them, but I don't. But we as a community have enough money in our community to finance what we want. It's just that our wants are not directed in this particular way. But we've got 1 million Black Conscious Voters is an organization that is working to register Black people, particularly in the South, but in targeted states, to get 1 million Black voters who will say, "I'm neither Democrat, I'm not Republican, I'm independent, I have a platform, I'm going to vote for the candidate who supports my platform and my agenda." And the other hand, you've got an organization called National Black Political Conference. That organization is recruiting Black people to run for Congress. Average, ordinary Black people who have a passion and an understanding of what the needs are in the community and an uncompromising spirit, so you don't end up shortchanging your constituents. That's what we need representing us in Congress. And until we marry the independent, conscious Black voter with the independent, conscious Black candidate, we're going to continue to get what we're getting now. And that, quite frankly, is chumped.
Dr. Cynthia McKinney, the former congresswoman from Georgia, speaking from Bangladesh. Michelle Sweet Mickey Martelly, who became president of Haiti in an election racked with fraud and foreign interference in 2010, left office this past weekend when his term expired. He's being replaced by a transitional government appointed by the country's parliament, which came into office in elections in August that were also fraudulent in the eyes of most Haitians. These were followed by presidential elections in October that were widely believed to be rigged, and the cancellation of a runoff election that had been scheduled for last month due to massive protests. Jerome France is a Haitian community activist now living in Miami. He says most Haitians still support the Fanmi Lavalas party of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was ousted in a U.S.-backed coup in 2004. We spoke with Jerome France shortly before the new interim Haitian government was announced.
What comes next is the tense moment that the Haitian people are leaving right now, and they are holding their breath, because you remember that if he leaves, the former assailant of Haiti in 2004 has promised to divide the country again. which would be unfortunate since more than anything right now, Haitians need level heads so that they can move towards a more peaceful Haiti, a reconciliating Haiti. Now, the forces that are on the ground are diverse, like I said. What comes across the wire is the fact that the people from PHTK, the present party, worry a lot because apparently, according to some people, they had looted a fortune. You remember there were billions of dollars available for the reconstruction of Haiti. And stories are coming out all the time about how some of that money was looted. So obviously, these people don't want a government to be established that would investigate these deeds. Another thing that happened is that during the campaign of Jovenel Moïse, the candidate for PHTK, the president's party, they used some state funds, which is illegal and prohibited by the decree that allowed for elections. Therefore, that would disqualify the party automatically, and that would impact not only Jovenel Moïse, but the whole party, including the members of the legislature that were elected under the banner of the party. And then you have the majority of the people that are still sympathetic to Lavalas, but a lot of people, even the well-meaning Haitians, are leery of Lavalas, not because they distrust them, but more because Lavalas has the potential to monopolize the elected political positions. Because Lavalas is the party of the popular movement. Therefore, if Lavalas systematically is given the opportunity to organize and go to elections, they can sweep every single post, which even though I agree with their position in terms of ideology, that is promoting the well-being of the people, I think that it would be unfortunate because we do need a different type of opinion so that we don't have groupthink. But that's something for the Haitian people to resolve between themselves. And that's all the people are asking, that they be given the opportunity to vote, to participate in true elections, free and fair elections. Voter suppression has to stop. That's what the Haitian people are saying right now. And that's what this movement is all about. The situation where the people have decided that it's time that they be allowed to select their own leaders. Now, what's funny is that all of these political, quote-unquote, political solutions that are promoted by the international community, they fail to realize that once you promote political solutions, you exclude the people. You don't give them the opportunity to choose their own leaders. And that's what the issue is. So there are many smaller forces on the grounds, but basically there is PHTK with the billions of dollars that were made available for them to control the political landscape in Haiti. And then there is the overwhelming majority gathered behind the Fermi Lavalas movement. There are also apparently, or what they promote as splinter groups that send candidates like Jude Celestin and Moïse Jean-Charles as a way to explain that Lavalas would be weakened. But still, the point is that you have one main body of people saying, we want to participate in elections. This business of 10%, 20%, 28% is unacceptable. We want to vote. People are stopping us from voting.
So you're saying that 12 years after the coup, Fermi Lavalas, the party of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, still retains the loyalties of a majority of the people?
I am not only saying that, I'm saying the only reason why they are doing all of the things that they have done for the past three, four years ever since Préval left power is to make sure that they keep Fermi Lavalas away from the presidency. Because they know that the people, whenever you have low turnout in Haiti, that means that they have managed to keep Lavalas out of the electoral process and the people won't participate. The minute the people with Fermi Lavalas participating in these last elections, the minute the people started to come out to vote, then they had to implement a reign of terror, especially in the popular sector, places like Cité Soleil, Carrefour, all of the places, the big ghettos, as they call them in Haiti, the big poor neighborhoods in Haiti. Once those people are mobilized, they know that they lose the election, they lose all control, because these people only trust one party in Haiti. That doesn't mean that they are not sympathetic to other parties, but they only trust one party to represent their interests.
What role has the United States been playing since the cancellation of the runoff?
Well, the United States has been saying that, well, we want the Constitution to be upheld, et cetera, et cetera. It is very convenient that they talk like that now, unfortunately. I wish that they had taken the same position when Martelly was not staging elections in the past that needed to be staged. They let the situation reach critical point. And then now they are talking about conclusion. But I think that the whole notion of demanding that the Constitution be upheld is a notion that has to do with the fact that if chaos, that's the belief of many in Haiti, if there is chaos in Haiti, then we will be justified in stepping in and then taking total control. That's what most people, most pundits in Haiti believe, that the international community has been setting things up so that there is all-out war in Haiti, so that they can step in and say, see, these people cannot take care of their own affairs. We have to step in. We have to take control of the country in order to protect the innocent. I don't remember the international community worrying about the innocent people dying in the Congo because people are trying to loot the gold of the Congo. Well, it's the same thing in Haiti. There is gold in Haiti, and some people are ready to kill poor people to reach that gold. And the American government, I believe, has been consistent those past few weeks about the Constitution, but they weren't so consistent earlier when the term of those senators and deputies was reaching the end of their terms, which caused for President Martelly to rule by decree. Anytime a president is ruling by decree, he has imperial powers that he implements. We can call him president, we can call it a democracy, but it is not. It is one man deciding the fate of a nation. Now the people of Haiti said, enough is enough. We want not only to be able to choose our elected officials, and we don't care for people to tell us, you have to do things according to the Constitution, and until he goes on the 7th, President Martelly has power, the power to decide your fate. The people are saying, no, we have taken control of our fate since when we decided that Martelly couldn't be trusted, and the people that they appointed to stage elections couldn't be trusted. Therefore, we are mobilizing so that our will be translated in the type of government. I don't think that the American government, which is very different from the American people, is ready to accept the fact that poor Haitians, people that they believe illiterate, but illiterate doesn't mean that people who cannot make their own decisions. I've taught at the university level in New York City for a long time, and I know that book smart doesn't mean life smart. People understand life, they understand the system that they are living under, and they know how to make their decisions. And if we respect them as human beings, we have to give them the opportunity to participate in the political process.
One of those Americans who participated in suppressing the aspirations of the Haitian people by rigging an election 5 years ago is running for president.
Yes, and there is a very important movement in the Haitian diaspora in the United States, making sure that if no one else, the African-American population of the United States know the role that she played in promoting misogynous president at the helm of the country. We stress misogyny because she is supposed to be a feminist leader. And when we look at the episodes that the Haitian women had to suffer because this guy was empowered to violate them. You know, I think it's unacceptable. And I think that she should be, if not made responsible directly, she should at least address the issue. But we know that he was taken with the help of the OAS from the number six position, according to some people, to the second position so that he could have a runoff. And then they overwhelmingly supported him in the election.
You mentioned Guy Philippe, the gunman and thug who was involved in the 2004 coup against President Aristide. Could he be one of the tools that foreign powers, the United States, might use to create the chaos that might justify yet another intervention in Haiti?
Anybody who has the potential of using terror tactics, and they have been using terror tactics on Haitians, even though they may be having Guy Philippe distracting the population. But the void core, the core void that was created by Martelly, inflicted a lot of pain in two places, in Cité Soleil and in Arcaye, when Martelly wanted to impose his will on a population in the west near Artibonite. Now, a lot of people were killed. We don't even know how many. But the fact is that every time they were killing people, more people would come out to march peacefully and defend themselves because they still retain their right of self-defense. So my point is that, yes, Guy Philippe is one of the tools, but we have to be careful as to how they use Guy Philippe as a tool. They may use him as a distraction while others inflicting pain on the poor people of the populations of the country. One thing that people may not have paid attention to, lately, since the announcement of the election, poor neighborhoods have experienced a rise in crime, apparently random crimes that people know were random, because the ones inflicting that pain had been released, some pardoned by President Martelly, and it has been denounced by popular organizations on a systematic level and by human rights organizations. They have said that these people were released so that at election time, they inflict pain and they terrorize the population and instill fear in them so that they don't come out to vote. Well, the people were afraid, maybe, probably, but the people were mobilized anyway, and they, like the people of Arcaye, who would come out in larger numbers every time they killed some of them, well, the people of Cité Soleil and Carrefour did the same thing because they knew. Because when they were facing the guns and firepower of the right-wing Martelly government, they were chanting, "We will get even come election day." And they were waiting for election day to elect a new leadership. So they are still mobilized. And today there is a big demonstration in Haiti because supposedly the legislature is going to have the National Assembly that is going to launch the beginning of the 50th legislature. And the people are saying, no, these people we didn't vote for in the deputy house, and we won't let it happen. And if it happens, we're going to keep on coming out in large numbers on denouncing the fact that they are stealing the state apparatus. So the people are clear as to what role Guy Philippe can play, but it is much more than Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe is one of the pawns. However, he has the firepower to inflict pain, to terrorize people, to kill young people, to kill babies, to kill old people, to kill the type of killing that doesn't make sense, to get the Haitian people in fight or flight mode, to get them to behave like animals. That's why I said that some people are apparently promoting an all-out war in Haiti. But I don't think that Guy Philippe is in control of his own actions anyway. He was controlled by forces in the past, and he is probably controlled by those same forces today.
So the popular position is that not only was the October presidential vote invalid, but that the sitting parliament previously elected is also illegitimate.
Well, they don't say previously elected, they say previously selected, because you remember, on August the 9th, there was supposed to have been elections in Haiti. And thugs came out with big, heavy artillery to keep the people at bay while they stuffed the ballot boxes. Now, what happened is that Secretary Kerry came to Haiti and asked that the next round be fair, that they rectify this behavior. Now, how can you ask for rectification of something that was not good and not right and expect the people coming out of these elections to be actual representation of the population? And the reason why they want compromised legislature is so that they can make them pass laws, change the constitution. The current constitution of Haiti says that all subterranean wealth belongs to the collectivity of Haitians. Therefore, if there is 20 billion, it belongs to the totality of Haitian population. If there is 100 billion, it belongs to the totality of the population. And that's what they want to change. They want to privatize that money, give it to foreign corporations, and then they will have it according to them. So they are terrorizing people into accepting the fact that the descendants of slaves shouldn't own any wealth in the Caribbean or anywhere else.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.